So, what I want to cover is what we did in Dart, a little bit of what we did in Archer, and how some of that's segueing into ANZ. And I want to start off with this diagram, and those people who've seen my talks before just snore quietly through this. This is a presentation that Liz Lyon from now UConn developed when she was working on the eBank UK presentation. And the reason I like it is that it provides a nice context for the overall life cycle of the kind of stuff that we were trying to do in Dart and Archer. Now, this is a UK diagram, so it talks about e-science where we would talk about e-research, but it's a life cycle and you can really start anywhere. And so, if you start here with e-experimentation, we would call it e-research. It's not all about instruments, obviously. So, there's two streams of activity out of that. There is the publication stream, the kind of stuff that typically goes into institutional repositories, and then there's the data stream, the kind of stuff that ends up in web servers, in some cases, institutional archives. I'll talk a little bit about that later on. And in some cases, in publisher holdings, if the journals have got that as a requirement. Bits of that end up in digital libraries of one sort or another. Some of the stuff in digital libraries ends up in what the UK calls virtual learning environments, what we'd call learning management systems. That gets used to train undergraduate students, those people who are unfit for use in the real world, and I say this as someone with a PhD, end up as graduate students, and some of those in turn who are completely delusional end up as researchers, and so the life cycle continues. So that's, if you like, the context, the overall context. And what we're trying to do in Dart was pick off that bit of that. So we're not digital libraries, we're not VLEs, we're not learning stuff, but we were trying to cover the entire e-research life cycle down in that bottom left-hand corner. So Dart was a proof of concept project. So those of you that have heard James Dalziel talk about Colas, one of the things he said very early on in the Colas talks was you cannot download a Colas. So Dart was kind of perhaps a little bit more real than that, but Dart wasn't intended to produce an off-the-shelf thing that you could download and install. It was really about testing out particular ideas to see if they worked. Funded, of course, by our very, very, very good friends at DEST. I'm contractually required to tell you that the funding was provided through SII as part of the thing that Adrian talked about earlier. And for those of you that are wondering why Dart, well, you know, if you've got a project called Arrow and you need to come up with a new one and you've already decided it's about data sets, that gives you the D. And once you've got the D, it's kind of all plain sailing from there on. Everybody except me thought that DA cubed RT was a terrible name, which is why it's Dart. I still think of it, you know, in my heart as DA cubed RT, which probably tells you more about me than you really need to know. Three partners for Dart. Lead was out of Monash University in Melbourne. Significant amount of work done in Queensland, both at the UQ and also at JCU, and a couple of my colleagues from JCU are sitting here and will be talking to you next. In fact, I think it's safe to say, oh, is it true for Dart? Certainly for Archer, the bulk of the dev work's happening at JCU. For Dart, it was probably a little bit more balanced. Which is not to say that Archer is unbalanced, but anyway. We were trying to pick off five technical areas of focus, and it was a very short, and I'll talk about those in a minute, but it was a very short project, so we only had 18 months. I've said finishing in June 2007 mostly because late in the project, DEST said to us, if you look down the back of the cushions, you'll discover that you were meant to have been working out what interest you've been accumulating, and we want you to spend that as well. So we're still spending a little bit of money that we got as earned interest. Lots of work packages, lots of project team members, and I should acknowledge here Dr. Geoff McDonnell, who was the project director for Dart. So, you know, I take not a lot of credit for Dart. He was the person who really did the hard work on making sure that we delivered. And he's now back in Hong Kong. So, what were we trying to do? I've already said we were trying to pick off the complete research life cycle. We were deliberately trying to focus on data-centric science, and particularly data-centric science coming out of instruments, although we did work in some other areas. Are you talking about Matatia? Okay, good. We were working in some other areas, particularly digital history, and you'll see some of that in the talk immediately following me. We were trying to focus on collaborative research, and in particular, annotation requirements around collaborative research. So, if you like, tools to help you do some of that shared connection stuff on top of the shared collections that Nosh talked about in his keynote. Intellectual privacy and security, customized portals. That's just lots of words. So, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. This particular picture is perhaps more than 1,000 words. This was the diagram in the bid document. Of course, you're all extremely bright people, so it will be immediately apparent to you what we were trying to do there. But some people apparently find that difficult to take in its full brilliance the first time they see it. So we have what we inside the project informally call the Vice Chancellor's version of the... no Vice Chancellors in the room? Good. Of what we were trying to do in Dart. And so collecting data sets, putting them into... collecting data, putting them into a raw data store, analysing that into an analyse store, providing collaborative tools for working with the data, annotation tools to support dynamic documentation and collaboration around the data, and then tools to publish this stuff out the end, and finally some discovery stuff on the right-hand side. And you can just see the Arrow logo because we're working with the Arrow Discovery Service for part of that. So that's a very high-level view, and of course, you know, the obligatory iconic aerial shot of the Great Barrier Reef. What else have we got? Oh, yes, it's a project that's run out of Monash, so although it's not the Monash synchrotron, it is really close to us, so we have to put the picture of the synchrotron in as well. So, five broad areas that we're trying to pick off. Data collection and monitoring, storage and interoperability, these are kind of in order, I guess. Content and rights, annotation and assessment, and discovery and access. So that's sort of the sequence within which you move through the life cycle. And what we've done is documented each of those 28 work packages in those areas on the website. So the subliminal logo down in the bottom right-hand corner is where you go if you want to get information about what it is we actually did. All of our source code is open source as a condition of the contract, thanks to our very good friends at DeskPeter. And it's also the right thing to do, by the way. I mean, it's about making sure that as many people as possible can get access to this. But we also produced a number of quite significant reports, so 100-plus page reports dealing with particular issues, as well as documentation for the stuff that we've produced. So all of those outputs are there for anyone to build on, and there are a number of research groups around the world that are taking particular components that came out of Dart and adapting them and embedding them in work that they're doing in the same way that we ourselves built on work that other people had done. What we achieved, so this is kind of text heavy, it's probably most useful to, rather than work you through all of that, to pick out a couple of high points and then show you a demo. So the things that I suppose I'm most excited about in what we did in Dart was probably the third and the last dot point. So the third dot point was about information management staff. And one of the things we've done at Monash University is develop an overarching information management strategy. And we have an ongoing focus on better information management across the university. And I'm looking to see if Catherine Dan's here. No, she's in the other lecture theatre. We've been working with a number of groups across the university, including records and archives, to develop information management techniques. What we did in this project is we took graduates coming out of a Bachelor of Information Management and Systems, taught at our Caulfield campus, and essentially gave them to research teams as a free resource. So we paid for people who were information management professionals, although at the start of their professional lives, to go into research teams and really to do whatever the researchers thought was useful. And so some of what they did was help the researchers improve their information management. Some of what they did was act as a conduit back to us. You know, the people I'm working with are having problems in this area. And part of what they did was act as a conduit from us back to the researchers. You know, here are some things we're building in Dart. Had you thought about using something like this? So that was a particular engagement with the researchers that had some unexpected benefits and is one that I'd like to try and continue in some way. And the last bullet point was, although this was a proof of concept project, we firmly believe that we couldn't just develop stuff in isolation. And so what we wanted to do was try and build things that were going to be of use to real researchers. And you'll see some of the humanities or the digital history stuff in a few minutes. What we largely focused on for our demonstration was the X-ray crystallography tools. And I should here acknowledge the work of Robin Polan up the back, and Anthony Beats, who asked the last question in the previous session, who really did a lot of work around the demonstrators in the DART project. And so what I'm going to do is just run you through a demo. Now, I'm not as brave as Scott, who is going to do four live demos tomorrow. Sorry, he's going to try and do four live demos tomorrow. So I'm wimping out, and I'm going for the screen capture, because I know that's going to work. So this is a screen capture of one slice through DART. So this is not all 28 work packages in a whirlwind tour. It's just a particular slice showing what we did for these crystallography researchers. So yeah, we've got a portal. Everybody's got a portal. Obviously, you need to log into the portal. For the purposes of this demo, I'll pretend to be Matt Swift, who did a lot of the work on pulling this together just before the eResearch conference at UQ. Those of you that recognize portals will see that this is being done in GridSphere. And so this is, if you like, the default view for our researchers. And if I can just stop it there, the way crystallography works is that you take proteins, you crystallize them, and which in itself is a significant challenge in some cases. You get a nice, well-shaped crystal, and then you stick it in a machine and blast it with X-rays. And so what you're doing is you're blasting it with X-rays and getting a series of images, and you rotate the crystal in typically 1 degree increments, and as you rotate the crystal, the X-rays diffract off the internal structure of the crystal in slightly different ways. So that image up there, that's the sample on the end, that's the piece of metal the sample's on, and that's a particular diffraction pattern. And you rotate it and you get a slightly different pattern. And so what we were doing, and this is work that the JCU people did, was build software that talked to the X-ray diffraction machine and automatically captured that data. Because the kind of readings you get vary depending on the temperature and the humidity, you need sensor stuff. There's a crystal cam view down there showing what's actually going on. So this is, if you like, information about the experiment. So you could start an experiment running and go home and still monitor what's going on with it. There's a storage interface into SRB, the storage resource broker. So you can see here that you can select objects and deposit objects. You can also add additional metadata. So this is not standard SRB metadata. This is additional metadata about that particular object. So let me pause at that point. So we're capturing data off the instrument. We're allowing people to put in additional metadata. We're storing those objects in an online store. The next phase, if you're a crystallographer, is you want to analyze all of those images and turn those dot patterns into something more sensible. And so what we created for them then was the ability to run compute jobs on a grid in order to derive the internal structure. And so this kind of processing is computationally quite intensive. So the more you can do in parallel via distributed processing, so this is kind of cheating hugely here. This actually takes significantly longer than it looks. But a Camtasia video that has 5 minutes of bars going across the screen is not really a whole lot of fun. So you can send these things out, parcel them out onto the grid, get the results back, and then you can derive from that process data what the internal structure of that particular crystal is. So, you know, coloured lights happen. Success! What a surprise. I'm shocked. So, we've now got an analysed crystal. One of the A's in DART was annotation. So the Jane Hunter's team, I think Jane Hunter's speaking tomorrow, is that right? Yeah. Jane Hunter's team at UQ developed some annotation tools for us. And the annotation tools allow you to have an annotation sidebar. This is the Annotia sidebar off on the left-hand side, which allows you to attach annotations not just to an object, but to things inside an object. So this is the solved structure for this crystal, which you can drag on. This is a free applet called JMOL. It's a Java applet that lets you visualize this stuff. But what you can do is you can click on an atom and you can say, I want to annotate an atom. So I guess in theory you could annotate quarks, but I've never seen anyone try and do that. But certainly annotating an atom is the smallest thing that I've yet seen. So you can create different types of annotations, and those annotations are stored not with the object, but on a separate annotation server. So as long as you've got read access to the object, you can annotate it. And you can pull up annotations that other people have made. And so if you like, you're now making connections around things inside objects, not just the objects themselves. So if you think about collections of objects, you've now got this parallel narrative discourse around things inside the objects itself. And then the last thing we did was the ability to publish objects into an open repository. In this case, we were using a Fedora-based repository. And so we provided some workflow which allowed people to fairly painlessly from inside their collaboration environment say, okay, I now want to publish this thing into the Fedora repository, and just to prove that that really happened, there's the object in Fedora. So that was, if you like, one sequence through some of the tools we developed in Dart to meet the needs of a particular group of users. And we worked with a number of other users, but the user population that made the most use of the most number of components were the crystallographers. And so that particular software that you saw there is currently being redeveloped as part of the Archer project that I'll talk about in a minute for use by the researchers, because they actually found this stuff, although I look at it now and I think, it looks a little bit clunky and we could do that better. But that was significantly better than what they did before. So they actually found that really useful, even though we look at it and we can see that it's full of holes and there's lots of things about it we hate. That was actually a lot better than what they were doing before. And what we're working on to provide to them now, hopefully will be better again. I'm actually chairing a session tomorrow morning with Ashley Buckle, who's one of the crystallographers that we've been working with. So if you're interested in hearing more about this work, come and hear Ash talk about it tomorrow. So that is the demo. So why am I talking about this at a Clever Collections conference? Well, because in order to have clever collections, you actually need high-quality data in the collections. Otherwise, they're, I don't know, less clever collections, slightly dull collections, I don't know. And there are particular things that I think you need in order to ensure that you've got high-quality data in your collection. First is, I think you need as much inbuilt quality control as possible. And so one of the work packages that JCU is developing was software that would look at data as it came in off the instruments and say, wait a minute, I think something's gone wrong here. So that, if you like, some smarts built into the data collection instruments that allowed them to automatically detect weird conditions like, the temperature of the ocean on the Great Barrier Reef's 2,000 degrees. You know, global warming's bad, but it's not that bad. So it would then raise a flag and say, first of all, something's wrong with your sensor probably, and second, you might want to throw away data in this particular range or do something else with it. So inbuilt quality control in a way that the researchers don't have to worry about too much is, I think, really important. You want to make it as easy as possible for them to provide high quality data into your collection. Second thing that I think is important is to make it as easy as possible for people to actually do the data collection. So something that says, here's a fantastic system that will allow you to collect data and deposit it into our repository, and you just have to fill in these 79 mandatory metadata fields is just not going to fly. Even for people who really love metadata, Joan, I'm sorry. So we need to make it as easy as possible to avoid having to do that. And some of that is semi-automated metadata extraction, and so we worked on stuff that would automatically extract as much metadata as we could. And of course, good data management around SRB. And so some of the researchers that we were working with, that alone was enough to make them want to work with us, because it meant they didn't have to have piles of DVDs stored in their labs. They could have this stuff managed in a much better way. So that was DART. DART finished in the middle of this year, and the successor project to DART is ARCHER, and you can see that I'm getting increasingly desperate as I make my acronyms here. This is a project that's been running for this year and will, if DEST allow us to roll the money over into next year, flop over into about, we think, about halfway through next year. That's taking the proof of concept work that we did in DART and turning it into real stuff, real production grade software that is going to be packaged up and much easier for people to deploy. The difference between DART and ARCHER is that ARCHER is explicitly working with a number of the NCRIS capabilities, so the National Collaborative Research Infrastructure Scheme. And the sweet spot for ARCHER is what we're calling data-centric collaboration. So it's a shrunk scope from what we tried to do in DART. We're aiming to have an internal prototype available in mid-December. Robin looks horrified every time I say this, but that's the date we're shooting for. And as I say, final versions mid-2008. So this is the architecture diagram. Okay, so obviously you're all asleep because I didn't hear any groans. We've got some enabling infrastructure down the bottom. We're working with the MAMS VO tools and the AAAF authentication infrastructure and the Kepler workflow environment from San Diego and grid computing, obviously. We've got two main object stores, an SRB-based store, a lot of the work that for that is being done by JCU, and collaborative workspaces based around Plone, all of the work, almost all of the work for which is being done by JCU. And then a series of components on top of this, the ability to invoke workflows, the ability to manage offline objects and then sync them back up, continuing our strong work on data collection and instrument integration, and tools around dataset deposition and export. And Jane Hunter's group at UQ is working on some generic metadata editing and management tools. So that's if you like, the ARCHER vision very, very quickly. In terms of the scope diagram, ARCHER is, if you like, that bit. We're not picking that piece off, because that's really taken care of by the institutional repositories that are now in every university in Australia. And that bit, the data bit, is getting picked off, or will get picked off, by ANZ. So, what's ARCHER doing now that ICI and ANZ are around? What we're doing is we're realigning ourselves. And so ARCHER will probably continue as a discrete project through to the middle of next year. But what we are currently doing is applying for NEAT, Nationally Research Architecture Task Force funding, for two separate strands of activity. One is building on the collaborative workspace stuff that JCU have been doing, and we're aligning that with ICI, the interoperation and collaboration infrastructure bit of platforms for collaboration, and then the data acquisition and management, which we're aligning much more with ANZ. And regardless of whether those projects get funded, we think that the outcomes of ARCHER are likely to be useful in some way in the ANZ repositories program. So having mentioned ANZ, it's probably worth thinking a little bit about why ANZ should care about clever collections or vice versa. One of the things that the ANZ document, and for those of you that haven't read it, there's a link on the last slide. One of the things that the ANZ document says is it's going to rely on well-curated collections. So it assumes that there are well-curated data collections out there. And I'm indebted to Adrian Burton for this phrase. We used to talk about institutional data repositories, but we're now talking about institutionally supported data repositories, just to make the point that they may not be the kind of traditional institutional repositories that we all know and love and care about. ANZ is talking about providing a variety of discipline-focused collections, so this is, if you like, a collection slice over the top of these repositories. And, of course, the collections registry, building on the ORCA work that APSR is doing, is likely to be one of the early ANZ utilities. So, if you like, collections are woven all the way through the ANZ work program. If you're interested in this at all, there's a document with the catchy title Towards the Australian Data Commons, which the link I'll give you in a minute. Or if you're interested, Rhys Francis, who's the main author of Towards the Australian Data Commons, is doing the closing keynote tomorrow and will, I imagine, be telling you about his baby. So that's the link to the Towards the Australian Data Commons. I toyed briefly with making it a tiny URL, but some people get upset about tiny URLs. So I thought I'd give you the thing in all its disaster. It would have been worse had it been a dest URL, because dest URLs are about 256 characters long before you get to the bit you actually care about. Right. Yeah, that's actually a short URL by dest standards. I'm not actually... Yeah, it's not a dest one. It's a PFC one. So anyway, that's the Towards the Australian Data Commons. There's the Dart website. There's the Archer website. Oh, I've acknowledged it twice. There we are. You've been acknowledged again. And I'll shut up there and leave time for some questions. Yeah, and you just had coffee. I mean, please. The check's in the mail, Adrian. Thanks. Yep. I thank the member for his question.
You mentioned the engagement model of basically embedded technologists.
Yep.
Could the minister... would you mind talking a little bit more about the successes
Yeah, so there were, it's an interesting model because the people that we embedded weren't discipline experts. And so if you look at the literature on this, there's a bit of literature that talks about the importance of having people who go into the research teams who've got a discipline background in the area. And we actually didn't do that. And I'd like to say we didn't do that deliberately, but that's actually not the case. We didn't do it because we just couldn't find any people with the right kind of discipline who also had an information management background. So that was... what we in the IT field call a feature, not a bug. That meant that it took a little bit longer to get some of the engagement working. You're obviously thinking in a researcher practice context, I guess, yeah. So it took a little bit longer, but I actually think that it may be better for you to go into a research team and say, I know nothing about the area that you operate in, assume that I don't know anything and start from scratch, rather than say to the researchers, look, I think I understand what you're doing, and then only to have it demonstrated later on that you really didn't. So I think a position of initial ignorance may actually be a plus. You know, either you know as much about the discipline as they do, in which case, why are you doing information management stuff for them, or you don't know anything, and I'm not sure that a position in between is that helpful. It also depends hugely on who you're engaging with. So there are some academics who are very positive and enthusiastic, and some who are really very, very focused on their research. And, you know, so what have you done for me this week? You know, I explained that to you last week. Why don't I have a solution now? Well, you know, we're still doing the requirements analysis. We haven't talked to the usability people, and we actually have to build it. You know, we'll have it ready for you in 6 months. Okay, fine. Come back and talk to me in 6 months. So managing those interactions is a bit of a challenge. And you need people that I think have got reasonably good people skills to be able to deal with some of the more challenging encounters that they might have with some of our more acerbic academics. But in general, it seemed to be an idea that worked. I mean, I think the ANZ Researcher Practice Program is going to have to work through a lot of this stuff, and I think it's going to be quite variable depending on who we embed and who they're embedded with and the expectation management. So one of the things we didn't do well with one of our early interactions was manage expectations. And so the researchers really thought that they could tell someone 1 week and the next week we'd have something for them. And it took us a little while to recover from them realising that wasn't the way it was going to be.
And they assumed that they actually had no information management capability whatsoever?
For some of them they did have none. Some of them thought they were doing an okay job, but weren't. People who were backing instruments up to DVDs that they stored on the shelf above the instruments. And some of them actually had pretty good internal systems. And so the ones that had pretty good internal systems, really, when we went to them and said, we'd like to give you this resource, they looked at it and they said, no thanks. But I do need help with this little bit here. And I think that for ANZ, we're going to get that entire spectrum. Everything from, I just need help with embedding a persistent identifier system, all the way through to, I've got no clue, where do I start? So a question back there. Yeah?
I'm at a regional university, but in the process of implementing a buyout, mm-hmm. And if I discovered a group of researchers that had data,
yep.
how could I utilise that?
You could certainly download, well, you could download SRB, the Storage Resource Broker, and the Personal Grid Library, PGL, which is that web interface that I showed you for putting stuff in and out of it. But if you're implementing an institutional repository, can I ask which one?
We're using Digital.
Okay, all right. I don't know how to help you with Digital. I was going to say that some of the other universities are experimenting with ways of putting data sets into Fedora-based or DSpace-based repositories. I honestly don't know enough about Digital to know how possible that's going to be. And so one of the issues that we've been working through at Monash, and this is a subject of another talk that I won't give you now, you'll be pleased to hear, is the relationship between the existing document repositories that we've got and the needs of data management. And so what we're trying at Monash is putting some really humongous data objects into our institutional repository and seeing how well that works and seeing if it breaks. But we may end up deciding that's a bad idea and that we'll go with a data repository and a document repository. It's still too early to say. Yeah, I mean, I'm around today and tomorrow, so please come and talk to me.
Okay.
Please, anybody.